what you're going to find at the end of the day, a mechanism that industry agrees with that recognize that polluters will pay.
Alaska senators discuss climate legislation with President Obama. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 29th of June. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, frustrated competitors on the long-distance motorcycle race from Florida to Homer.
The maps are wrong, the routes are wrong. The first checkpoint was Ormond Beach, and I smelled a rat at that point when they didn't ask for my ID.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Crane accidents are on the rise around the nation, and making sure that crane operators are properly trained and certified is crucial to minimizing accidents in Alaska. Equally important is ensuring that riggers and signal persons are adequately trained. More information is available at 1-800-656-4972. Good, safe jobs are Alaska's future. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
Both of Alaska's senators attended a White House meeting today on climate change and energy legislation. They were among a group of 23 senators summoned by President Obama to the closed-door meeting to talk over policy. The White House called it a constructive exchange and said the president is still pushing for putting a price on carbon. The White House says that would make clean energy profitable and hold polluting companies responsible. Some of the Democrats leading the charge on a climate change bill, including Massachusetts Senator John Kerry, say they're willing to compromise on how to price pollution, and independent Senator Joe Lieberman told reporters afterward that some Republicans seemed willing to negotiate on a scaled-back carbon pricing scheme. But Senator Lisa Murkowski, whose opinion carries weight in the GOP since she's the Energy Committee's top Republican, says she isn't seeing members of her party bending on that.
Now, the president mentioned, appropriately so, that the thing that Americans are thinking about first and foremost right now is jobs and the state of our economy. And that's why I believe that a cap and trade provision will not be included, because that is a hit to our economy that we simply cannot afford at this point in time.
Alaska Senator Mark Begich sounded more optimistic after today's White House meeting.
Today was really a good discussion, just to talk about all the different legislation, where people are, and it's clear that in that room, people want to get an energy plan put together. Obviously, there's disagreements, but I think there seemed to be some willingness.
Begich said in advance of the meeting that he thinks momentum is growing to move forward on a climate bill, but he says Republicans are dangling cap and trade as a target because it's language that's politically unpopular. But he says that's not productive because there are other ways to go about pricing carbon.
What you're going to find at the end of the day, a mechanism that industry agrees with that recognize that polluters will pay for a portion of this cost, and that consumers will reap the benefit financially in some form. That's the mechanism we're going to go down.
Begich says he doesn't think the Senate will be able to pass the full-fledged climate change Kerry-Lieberman bill before the November elections, but he thinks it can move forward on some elements. The House has already passed an aggressive climate change bill. Both Democrats and Republicans in the Senate say whatever goes before their body won't be as sweeping. A small hydroelectric generator has begun powering two remote communities in eastern Alaska as part of a project to develop a cheaper and cleaner alternative to diesel fire generation. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
The 25-kilowatt turbine, powered by the Yukon River, began generating electricity on Sunday for both Eagle and Eagle Village. The two communities of about 200 people are located on the banks of the Yukon, about 200 miles east of Fairbanks, near the Canadian border. The hydrokinetic turbine system looks sort of like a big high-tech egg beater suspended into the river from an aluminum catamaran-style barge that's anchored to the shore and river bottom. Alaska Power and Telephone has been studying and developing the system at Eagle since the early 1990s. Mark McCready, an AP&T spokesman, says if the company can work out the bugs, AP&T hopes the turbine will take some of the load off the company's diesel-powered generators and eventually save the utility and its customers a lot of money and significantly reduce production of greenhouse gases by the Eagle power plant.
The real goal or end game of that is to displace the diesel that's being burned and has been burned for decades here to power folks' homes and businesses.
AP&T estimates that the turbine eventually could save 57,000 gallons of diesel fuel annually. Eagle Mayor Bo Fay says he'd like to see the turbine reduce the costs of generating power.
It's not going to reduce the price of electricity. I think that the only thing that they could hope for is that it will slow the rate of increase.
McCready says AP&T is still working the bugs out of the system. Like any pilot project, the river turbine has had its problems. AP&T workers had a tough time over the past couple of weeks setting it up, especially getting the barge in place at the best spot in the river, and then keeping it in place in the Yukon's very powerful current. McCready says at one point the barge almost got away before it was wrestled back into place some 10 minutes later.
Deployment of an anchoring system, deployment of the actual barge, the setting up of the turbine, all of those things have presented some real technical and physical challenges simply because of the dynamics and the incredible energy that's out in the Yukon River. So being land-based as telephone and energy people, to get out on the river and deploy something of this nature has been, on certain days for sure, two steps forward and one step backward.
The project will provide important information on how to operate a power-generating turbine in a river filled with silt and driftwood, a river that can sometimes unleash enormous destructive power, like the floods in the spring of 2009. McCready says the turbine will operate only while that stretch of the Yukon is free of ice, from breakup to freeze-up.
Our intent is to run it through the season where we do not have ice on the river, and once the river starts to ice over, we'll take the unit out, we'll dry dock it, we'll do maintenance on it, and after breakup in the spring, put it back in the river.
There's been some skepticism expressed over the $3.2 million spent on this project from a federal grant through the Denali Commission of Alaska, and there still are a lot of concerns, such as the impact of turbines on the river environment and subsistence fishing. But AP&T and other advocates say the turbine promises to help bush communities generate power inexpensively and with little environmental impact. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, an Alaskan turns in a jaw-dropping performance at one of the country's premier ultra-marathons.
Adjectives will fail you. I mean, it was remarkable, incredible, a first-time effort on this course.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. 90% of those who drown in boating accidents in Alaska are men. To get men to wear their life jackets, have them fill out a Pledge to Live card and make a promise to wear their life jacket every time they get in a boat. Every time. Most men won't listen to messages like this, but they might listen to you. Go to pledgetolive.org to get a card or find one at your local car Safeway. Make them promise so they make it back alive. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety Program.
Anchorage Democrat Mike Dugan has begun treatment to remove a brain tumor. Surgery is scheduled for Thursday. Announcement of the condition came from House Democrats this morning that explained the meningioma tumor is usually non-cancerous and was discovered during an examination earlier this month. Beth Grotula is the House Minority Leader. She says Dugan has planned on needing about 1 month of convalescence after the surgery.
As far as brain tumors go, this one looks treatable, not malignant, and the doctor that Mike's seeing in Washington, you know, is just a real expert on this. I've read a lot about him, and he told Mike that he could do this. So we're just expecting Mike to get through it and be back and as strong as ever.
Dugan expects to be working again this fall. More than 2,600 University of Alaska employees have said they're interested in voting on union representation with the Alaska State Employees Association, or ASEA. Now a 15-day process is underway, after which the Alaska Labor Relations Association will hold a pre-election conference. Then a date will be set for the ballot election. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The ASEA is targeting a group of over 2,500 employees at campuses statewide, not already covered by other unions. ASEA Administrator Jim Duncan says the UA staff group could benefit from unionizing.
Our research has shown that their wages have fallen behind, that they are normally thought of last when it comes to wage increases and other provisions because they are not in a union. Secondly, we believe that they as employees deserve the protection, the worksite protection and representation that a strong union can give them.
The ASEA already represents 8,000 state and municipal employees in Alaska. UA spokeswoman Kate Ripley contests the union's claim that the university staff group's salaries don't stack up against the state.
When we look at it and really compare like jobs to like jobs, university jobs to state of Alaska jobs, we find that our salaries really are keeping pace. And in some cases, they exceed them. Now, there are a couple cases where they're lower, and we're looking into that. But in general, overall, most of the positions really are keeping pace with state of Alaska positions.
Ripley says another ASEA assertion that UA staff members aren't seeing the same percent salary increases as unionized university workers also isn't accurate. She says increases for union and non-union employees are set according to different time frames but provide similar percent pay raises.
With collective bargaining agreements, they usually cover 3 years, and with this group of unrepresented staff, it's year to year. But the most recent example is the staff amount for FY11 was identical to the one-year monetary amount for the UAFT, which is the University of Alaska Federation of Teachers.
University jobs already offer excellent health care and retirement benefits and include free tuition. Ripley cautions that another union won't increase the amount of money the institution has to spend on employees. UAF Museum of the North worker and Union Organizing Committee member Andrew Quentin isn't critical of the university.
I love working at the university. I'm very happy with my job. And I certainly think that the university has treated us very well. But that's not the issue. And the point of unionization is not to antagonize the university, but to have a stronger voice at the statewide level and as well as in Juneau.
Quentin says that's especially important right now at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, where the administration is coping with a budget shortfall and is in the process of implementing cuts. Another union organizing committee member, 8-year UAF development officer Naomi Hearn, is also adamant about the importance of better representation.
The university has taken good care of me. And I have, in turn, done a lot of great work for the university. It's very much a mutual relationship. But there have been times along the way where it hasn't been as mutual. And sometimes you get blessed and you have great supervisors who bring you to the table. And sometimes you don't. And for me, the union doesn't necessarily boil down to numbers. It boils down to the guarantee that my voice will be heard.
UA's Ripley says the non-unionized staff are currently represented through campus councils and a statewide administrative committee. She says unionization would formalize the relationship with the university and eliminate employees' current ability to negotiate salary with supervisors.
If a staff person feels that, you know, maybe they deserve a raise, they can come into their boss, talk about it. The boss can look at other positions that are similar in the university and have that flexibility to give that employee a raise. Well, that won't be the case with this group if they become unionized.
Ripley says salaries for unionized workers are negotiated through a collective bargaining process. The ASEA hopes to hold an election this fall in Fairbanks. I'm Dan Bross.
Two men simultaneously finished the Hoka Hay Motorcycle Challenge on the Homer Spit early Monday morning, staking their claim to the $500,000 prize money in the 8,000-mile endurance race. The Hoka Hay has not been without controversy, however, as some riders are claiming the whole thing might be a scam. KBBI's Aaron Selbig has more.
44-year-old Hoka Hay rider Charles C. Lynn of Sorrento, Florida, died Saturday after his motorcycle went into a drainage ditch outside of Douglas, Wyoming. That according to the Casper Star Tribune newspaper. Police suspect that Lynn had fallen asleep shortly before going into a spin and running off the road. Lynn was not wearing a helmet. 2 days later, at 4:20 a.m. Monday morning, two riders, Frank Kelly of Prosperity, South Carolina, and Will Barkley of Highland, Florida, became the first riders to cross the finish line in front of Kevin Bell Arena on the Homer Spit. Kelly and Barkley will have to pass a variety of tests before they are declared the official winners, says Hokahay organizer Annie Malloy.
There's drug tests, there's lie detector tests, there's DMV checks, things like that, that all have to pass the muster. But we had two great guys come across this morning at 4:20, and was really cool.
On Monday afternoon, another rider, Homer resident Eric Wickery, pulled into the arena parking lot only to find the finish line had been taken down and no one was there to greet him. Wickery says that after unexpected bike repairs, several near wrecks, and an encounter with a grizzly bear on the Cassier Highway, the race nearly finished him. Wickery, a marine electrician whose ride was sponsored by several Homer businesses, admits to skipping parts of the prescribed route, including the final checkpoint in Fairbanks, because he believed early on that something just wasn't right about the Hokahay.
The maps are wrong. The routes are wrong. The first checkpoint was Ormond Beach, and I smelled a rat at that point when they didn't ask for my ID. They didn't want to know my odometer. All they wanted was me in the service department, the hard sell to get my bike in there. Oh, it needs to be checked out. They're waiting on you. They'll get you right in. I'm like, no, the bike's fine.
After several riders became lost in Alabama, says Wickery, 10 of them gathered at a convenience store and held an impromptu meeting.
And I said, well, what if it's all a diversion? All this is a diversion. The first one to Homer wins the money. Well, the reality is there's been a lot of lawsuits already filed against the organizers, and nobody's going to get that money, whoever did truly win it, because nobody can honestly pass a polygraph saying they stayed en route, because the routes are wrong. They don't lead to where you're supposed to be. So I think they've set it up so they can disqualify everyone, and the money stays in trust with the Sioux tribe.
Malloy says that she and fellow organizers have been deflecting accusations that the race is a hoax since the beginning. Asked about the death of Lynn, Malloy declined comment, referring to a Hokahay press release that was not sent to KBBI in time for this story. A telephone call Monday to Hokahay organizer Beth Durham was disconnected, and subsequent calls and emails were not returned in time for this story. Wickery says, scam or not, he's proud just to have finished the ride.
There's an awful lot of angry people at this point. So I'm not. It took me about 3,000 miles to get over my anger. I was pissed at first. I know that I've been off route, so I'm not in a contender for the money, but I did want to be the first guy in Homer, or at least the first Alaskan in Homer, and I guess I have. So I'm third, technically.
Malloy says that despite some bumps in the road, the Hokahay has already been a big success.
You know, I have a lot of wives here in town. Their husbands are having the trip of their life, and they're thanking us for putting this beautiful route together. You know, they're saying it's really life-changing.
In Homer, I'm Aaron Selbig.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Tech Alaska, operators of the Red Dog Mine. Thanks to Alaskans like you, Tech Alaska can continue to deliver jobs and benefits for another 20 years. Details at reddogalaska.com. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
A Juneau man has set a record in one of the oldest and most challenging mountain races in the world. In a race that must be completed within 30 hours, Jeff Rose on Saturday ran the 100-mile Western States Endurance Run in half that. As KTOO's Rosemary Alexander reports, Rose is considered one of the top three ultramarathon runners in the world.
This year, more than 300 runners finished the race in under 30 hours. Jeff Rose did it in 15 hours, 7 minutes, and 4 seconds, 23 minutes faster than the record set in 2004. A group of local runners and friends greeting the lean 34-year-old at Juneau Airport yesterday. John Nagel among them. Nagel knows the Western State Endurance. He's competed 3 times. He says it's hard to describe Rose's accomplishment.
Adjectives will fail you. I mean, it was remarkable, incredible, a first-time effort on this course.
It was the first time Rose has run in the Western States Endurance. It starts at the 6,200-foot base of Squaw Valley Ski Resort in the Sierra Nevada Mountains. In the first 4 miles, it climbs nearly 3,000 feet to Emigrant Pass. From there, Rose says, it's just about all downhill.
You end up with a lot of downhill over the last 95 miles. You climb for 5 miles, and then it's more downhill than up after that.
Greg Sunderland is Western State's race director.
It is a downhill race, and Anton Krupicka, who was in second, said he'd never seen anybody run downhill as easily and quickly as Jeff did.
The trail climbs a total of 18,000 feet and descends 21,000 feet into Auburn, California. The race started Saturday at 5 a.m. 100 miles later, Rose reached the finish line shortly after 8 p.m.
Fun. That's my top priority, and this was a lot of fun. It was the most competitive 100-mile race I've ever done, for sure.
Rose and world-class runners 26-year-old Anton Krupicka of Boulder, Colorado, and Spain's 22-year-old Jillian Jornet stayed together for the first half. But at Devil's Thumb Canyon, Rose says the two younger men motored ahead.
It's a really tough climb. I drop into a canyon. It's the first point of the day where it's really hot. And then it's like a 2-mile climb just straight up out of a canyon. You know, for people around here, it's like climbing up the lower part of the Mount Juno Trail.
Rose says about 25 miles from the end, he was able to put on the gas.
It's a lot more enjoyable chasing someone than being chased by somebody. So I think that was a big part of the reason why it was so fun.
I understand you took a dunk in the American River just before the end.
Yeah, there's a river crossing at mile 78. It was hot. It was about low 90s at that point, and they were crossing us over the river on rafts, and I got to the other side, and I soaked in the river for 30 seconds, and I think I made up that 30 seconds within about a minute after leaving there because I was instantly energized by being cooled off.
The Western States Endurance Run was Rose's 7th win in 7 100-mile mountain marathons. Sunderland says he's keeping good company.
Jeff Rose and Anton Krupicka and Kilian Jornet are probably the three top ultra runners in the world now.
A chef at Rainbow Foods, Jeff Rose regularly runs in the mountains around Juneau. A typical training run would be up Mount Roberts to Sheep Mountain, back to Clark Mountain, down into Granite Basin, and down Perseverance Trail to town. That's about 4 hours for Rose. He does it at least a couple of times a week. In Juneau, I'm Rosemarie Alexander.
A unique program is getting started next month to help high school students in rural Alaska find success with post-secondary education. Take Wing Alaska is an intensive 3-year effort that will try to address the culture shock students often face at a big city campus. 30 high school juniors from the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta will begin the program with a 12-day camp at the University of Alaska Anchorage on July 7th. They will have additional immersion experiences over the next 2 years and support during their first year of college. As part of our series on Alaska Native education, I talked with Matthew Turner, the camp director. He says about 80% of rural students who start at UAA end up dropping out, mainly because of cultural pressures.
The changes that they experience moving from close-knit communities to a larger community where some of the expectation in an academic environment is that you're going to sink or swim. The other really interesting pressures we hear are about the pressures to return home by these students, you know, the ones that do decide to set out and go to college or to post-secondary ed. You know, they're getting a lot of calls from friends and family and parents even saying, you know, come home, come home, come home. And that's a tough one for them to deal with. And finally, there's a kind of a negative, and this came up a lot with different people talking about kind of a negative pressure that they get when they come home. Let's say, you know, I'm in college and I come home for the summer and everybody's, ooh, college boy, too fancy for us. And that there's a lot of negative social pressure that they get from their own community.
Hmm. How did you choose the participants? How did that process work?
Well, it was an interview process. We focused on just two school districts with two very enthusiastic superintendents of those districts who were ready to do this, and two school districts that are also struggling. So Lower Kuskokwim and Lower Yukon. One of the criteria I think is most interesting is we were looking for students whose parents had not completed post-secondary ed. You know, the fact is, you are more likely to successfully complete post-secondary ed if your parents did. It's an expectation then. And so to kind of break that cycle, we intentionally were choosing young people for whom their folks may not have completed any kind of thing after high school.
So part of the effort is to teach the kids to be independent thinkers and autonomous, as you mentioned. But family support, as we know, is important. So how critical is it for the families to be involved?
Very critical. And what we're also including in here is we've asked each young person to identify a sponsor. So there's someone in that community outside of their family who's been through post-secondary ed and who will also be working closely with the young people throughout the 3 years and with their families. So the idea being that if I'm off at school and my family is freaking out about how much books cost or, you know, how come he doesn't call anymore, the sponsor's there to say this is perfectly normal, you know, your kid is being inundated with a lot of information right now and enjoying learning how to live on their own. So don't panic. Things like that. So essentially the sponsor not only sponsors the young person, but also ideally is going to be working with the family to help them support their young person as best as possible.
And what are your hopes for the success rate for the program? How many of these 30 students do you think can successfully complete college?
Well, I guess I think all of them can. What I hope is that they make the best choice for themselves. It's not a given that every person needs to go to college. My hope is that these young people are thinking hard about their future and the future of their community and looking at what their needs are, what the needs for the community are, and then making really good decisions about how to make those things align as best they can. And if that means jumping right into an educational career out of high school, great. If that means sticking around the community and growing more there, fine. But I think to make good decisions, and then my hope is that they'll have the confidence and skills to follow through with those no matter what they are.
Matthew Turner is camp director for Take Wing Alaska. The program is funded by the U.S. Department of Education. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. You can find archived stories from our Alaska Native Education series there also. Follow us on Twitter at aprn. We had reports tonight from Tim Ellis and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Aaron Selbig at Homer, and Rosemarie Alexander in Juneau. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. And by the Alaska State Elks Association, offering the Alaska State Elks Camp in the Matanuska Valley, available for weddings, parties, reunions, and other public or private meetings. Information at alaskastateelks.com. If you've been through a lot of bad things and you feel like everyone would be better off without you, suicide isn't the answer. You're not alone. You have people who love you, and there is help. Call the Alaska Care Line at 1-877-266-HELP. Call, share, and live. If you're thinking about suicide, call for help at 1-877-266-HELP. This message sponsored by the Mindy Schloss Memorial Fund and the State of Alaska.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.